From the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, I'm Stuart Patrick, and this is The World Unpacked. Israel is in turmoil, confronting one of the greatest political crises since the nation was established 75 years ago. The proximate cause of this conflict is the effort by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who leads the most right-wing government in Israeli history, to curtail the power and overhaul the composition and rules governing the Israeli Supreme Court. The government's efforts have galvanized opposition from a broad swath of Israeli society, encompassing trade unions, students, members of the military, and more secular Israelis who fear that it would give the executive unchecked authority and increase the nation's shift in a right-wing and religious direction. After weeks of protests, Netanyahu has retreated a bit, announcing a delay in pursuing this legislative agenda and signaling his openness to compromise. With me today to unpack this turmoil and what it means for the future of democracy in Israel is one of the world's premier experts on Middle East politics. Aaron David Miller is a senior fellow here at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, who has served as an advisor and negotiator for several U.S. presidents. He's a prolific author and commentator, including as host of the live virtual event series Carnegie Connects. As a note to our listeners, we are taping this episode on March 30th. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Stuart, it's a pleasure to be here with The World Unpacked.
Well, it's wonderful to have you here, particularly at this time that's quite exciting in Israel. Can you guide us through and provide some more background? What's the cause of this turmoil, and what do you think is at stake for the state of Israel?
Yeah, fundamental questions, particularly, Stuart, as Israel approaches its 75th anniversary since independence next year. It's interesting to point out that neither the borders nor the identity of the state of Israel are yet fixed 75 years after independence. Now, in 1851, 75 years after our independence, you could argue that neither the borders nor the identity of our republic was fixed. But there are fundamental differences, right? I mean, we have non-predatory neighbors to our north and south and fish to our east and west, and a rather expansive continent, and a unique political system. However imperfect, it's worked over the decades. Israel has a set of security changes and a much more complicated political system. So it's a fraught question, and the answer is fraught as well. I think the point of departure, in my judgment, is the emergence after five elections in 4 years of the most right-wing fundamentalist government in Israel history. Netanyahu, Benjamin Netanyahu, 73, the longest governing prime minister in the history of the state, exceeding even Israel's arguably greatest prime minister, David Ben-Gurion, came into office with an agenda. And he's put together a coalition of 64 seats out of 120 in the Knesset, which is a substantial majority by Israeli standards. The government, though, has willful purpose. And it, I would argue it basically has committed itself publicly, actually, to two agendas. One is the issue of judicial reform, which is a nice way of describing a much more profound determination to transform the Israeli political system, and annexation, which two ministers in the Netanyahu government, one Itamar Ben-Gvir and the other Bezalel Smotrich, are determined to find a way to annex in anything but name most of the West Bank to Israel proper, and to ensure that Jerusalem would never serve as the capital of a Palestinian state, prevent two states from emerging, generally speaking. So those are the two challenges. And right now, it's the issue of judicial reform that has taken center stage.
So let's think about this in historical context, as you had already begun to do. From its founding, my understanding is that religious and more secular Jews have been seeking to see that their values are embodied in the state of Israel. Is this just the latest chapter in sort of a long-running dispute, or is there something distinctive about this particular moment in Israeli history?
I mean, you could argue that it's a headline, but it's a culmination of certain trend lines, historical trend lines that have been building and identified since the state was created. Israel has no formal constitution, and David Ben-Gurion at the time of independence was simply unwilling to challenge the religious parties, which he needed in order to govern. And Israel has security challenges. I mean, can you imagine trying to draft a constitution during a war of independence? The U.S. had the luxury, you know, of bringing 50-odd white males to Philadelphia, relative tranquility over a period of summer with no air conditioning, to draft this extraordinary constitution. Israel never did that. They don't have a formal Bill of Rights. So these tensions between religious and secular, between the judiciary and the executive, legislative, have been building for quite some time. I think, though, that it crystallized largely as a consequence of the emergence of the government, which clearly has an agenda that it's determined to fulfill.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the nature of Israel's governing coalition and particularly the inclusion of some of the more right-wing elements, which we haven't necessarily seen, at least in my understanding, in Israeli politics before in such a prominent position?
Right. In order to govern, since Israel does not directly elect a prime minister, as we directly elect, with Electoral College, indirectly directly elect a president, in order to govern, you need a coalition. And over the past 4 years, Israel's had five elections. Now, for a relatively functional democracy, that's rather remarkable. And the reason is because one Benjamin Netanyahu, who heads the largest and most coherent political party in the country, the Likud, basically made a strategic decision that because of his ongoing trial for bribery, fraud, and breach of trust, now 3 years in, by the way, in a Jerusalem district court before three magistrates, judges, with emphasis on the word judges, he needed to withhold the formation of any government until he was assured of gaining a parliamentary majority. He finally did because his natural coalition partners, the religious, ultra-religious and the religious Zionists, were much easier to corral into a government than the previous government, which is a hodgepodge combination of left, center, and even center-right parties. The problem was, of course, that in order to govern, he included two parties, two sets of parties. One, religious Zionism, which is a coalition of two smaller parties, headed, as I mentioned before, by one Bezalel Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir, and two smaller religious parties. Let's call them the ultras. These are the Haredim, those who tremble, the ultra-religious parties. That coalition ensured 64 seats, but it also guaranteed that Mr. Netanyahu, despite his canny capacity to govern, probably the most clever politician in the country and the most forceful one, they hold him hostage. And they hold him hostage on two fundamental issues with which their interests, judicial reform, quote-unquote, so-called reform, and annexation kind of coincide. He is by far the most moderate member of this government, which speaks volumes about the character and nature of the present government. So there he is now with 64 seats, wanting to move forward on both judicial reform. And he reached the point, frankly, where even Mr. Netanyahu, so skilled at reading the political real estate and understanding Israeli public opinion, basically became somebody else. And that's also key. The risk-averse, cautious, pragmatic Benjamin Netanyahu of old seems to have been transformed into the risk-ready, ideologically driven, desperate Benjamin Netanyahu with which we are dealing now.
Yeah, exactly. Given the number of years and what we've seen over the years since, I guess, 1996, when I guess he first became prime minister, it's quite remarkable.
It is. And what brought about the change? I mean, was it his trial and the existential reality that if he doesn't find a way to delay it, immunize himself, he's either going to be convicted or he's going to cut a plea deal, which probably would ensure his departure from politics.
Are there background forces similar to the United States that have led to this, because this sort of extraordinary degree of political polarization? I mean, do you see certain parallels between what's going on in the United States and Israel?
Yeah,
or
I mean,
are these sui generis?
Well, they're Mars and Venus, but I think we make the mistake of conflating the fact that somehow, because Israel's a democracy in the Middle East, it's somehow like ours. It is in many respects free press, committed to pluralistic values. Set aside the Israeli occupation for a moment or the West Bank. No, I think there's intense polarization. And one could argue that judicial reform has a long tail here. And it's driven by the needs of the more traditional, religious, nationalist-oriented Israeli Jews to push back against what they perceive as the secular elite, which in many respects has dominated the country for the first 30-plus years of independence until the late 70s. So this tension, and it also has an element of ethnic difference between Ashkenazi Jews, those Jews of Eastern European or European origin, as opposed to the Mizrahim, the Easterners, or the Sephardim, which are Jews from other parts of Southern and Central Europe and the Middle East. There's definitely that class element here. But again, I come back to the reality, you and I would not be having this conversation if it wasn't for one Benjamin Netanyahu.
A number of observers have suggested that this is a defining crisis for the future of Israeli democracy. And it's also often been said by more secular and progressive folks in Israel that Israel can be either a Jewish state or a democracy, but has a hard time being both. Does this crisis at all speak to that longstanding debate?
You know, I think it does. It's clearly, Israel's committed in the Constitution as a democratic state, but as a Jewish state. I would argue to you that Israel right now would be best described as a preferential democracy. 9 million humans, 2 million Palestinian citizens of Israel or Israeli Arabs. Let's for a moment put aside the issue of the 2.5 million Palestinians in the West Bank, the 1.9 million in Gaza, and the several hundred thousand in East Jerusalem. It's a preferential democracy. Those 2 million Israeli Arabs, Palestinian citizens of Israel are guaranteed under the Declaration of Independence full equality, but they suffer from social and economic discrimination, right? That's not the issue right now. The issue right now, frankly, and the Palestinians would actually describe it this way, is what do Jewish Israelis do about the nature and character of their state? All right. So democracy for all, which has been a slogan during the early phases of demonstration, is not the focus of the vast majority of the 6% of 9 million people who actually have gone out into the streets. That would be, my math SATs were really bad, but I think that's got to be 30-some million Americans, 6%, maybe. At any rate, what's at stake, I think very much so, in the minds of the Israelis out in the streets, is the image of the kind of country they want to live in, a traditional, populist, religious, majoritarian state that may ignore the rights of minorities, or a secular, pluralistic, accommodates religious Jews, democratic state, state for all of its citizens, including the 2 million citizens.
I'll note that in an ironic twist, perhaps Bibi himself just attended the second summit for democracy.
Right.
Yeah, co-sponsored by the United States virtually. And he described Israel as a beacon of democracy and sort of depicted all these folks in the streets as, hey, this is just the normal rough and tumble of democratic politics. This is the sort of thing that one expects. But what you're suggesting is that at least in the sort of gravity of the situation, it's a little bit more than just business as usual. Israeli politics always having been colorful and often quite, it's hardball bare knuckles. Often.
Most Israeli prime ministers have sought to dodge the issue. Mm-hmm. Netanyahu, because of the pressure from his coalition partners, his own trials decided to take it on head on. And look what happened. I mean, he's mobilized the largest, most coherent, cohesive, durable, cross-sectional demonstrations in the history of the country, and including hundreds, if not thousands, of military reservists, which I think brought this to a head. The firing of the Minister of Defense, Yoav Gallant, one of his senior members of his Likud party, a career military man, I think brought this to a fore.
He was the first to break ranks with the prime minister. He said giving the government final say over all judicial appointments and weakening the powers of the Supreme Court was a threat to Israel's security. It cost him his job.
It demonstrated, I think, in the minds of so many Israelis that Mr. Netanyahu was prepared to put his own personal political interests above the sort of iconic security interests of the state. And what this has opened the door to, fascinating, is now the Israeli Defense Forces, the IDF, you could argue has now become, the door is open now to allowing, permitting, acquiescing in members of the Israeli military to protest in a way we've never seen before. And these, and because Israel hasn't fought a ground war, arguably, since 2006 in Lebanon, the reserves, particularly in the Air Force and the intelligence services, are the elites and critically important for Israel's military readiness.
When we come back, I'll ask Aaron about how the United States has been watching this unfold and what this all portends for Bibi Netanyahu's future and how it might end. Hey, thanks for listening to The World Unpacked. We have a lot of fun putting on this show for y'all, but we can't do it without your help. To support the work we do here, please visit ceip.org/donate. Thanks.
Like many strong supporters of Israel, I'm very concerned. And I'm concerned that they get this straight. They cannot continue on this road.
Aaron, I'd love to get your take on how this crisis is reverberating in U.S.-Israeli relations from both sides. Let's start with the United States. President Biden annoyed, to put it charitably, Prime Minister Netanyahu by expressing concern over his plans. And Bibi reminded him that Israel was a sovereign nation and would make its own choices. It's no secret, of course, that Democrats have long soured on Netanyahu, but he has a lot of fans among the GOP. How is this being received in U.S. domestic politics?
Well, like everything else, Stuart, in our sort of argue culture society, Israel has become an extremely partisan issue. The GOP has set itself up unquestionably, at least for the last decade, as the Israel right or wrong party, the go-to party. I wonder if you could find, since the judicial reform package was introduced in January, a single statement by any Republican House or Senate member criticizing the issue of judicial reform. And Netanyahu understands this. It was this partisanship with respect to the U.S.-Israeli relationship was deepened and accelerated by the behavior, of course, of the previous administration, particularly the president, with whom Mr. Netanyahu bonded. But it's more than that. In 2015, in an effort to oppose what was then the Obama administration's efforts to pass the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Iran nuclear agreement, Mr. Netanyahu accepted an invitation to address Congress and ran the administration and directly interfered and interceded into American politics. And it is no secret that Benjamin Netanyahu, I'd add another politician here, Mohammed bin Salman, a.k.a. MBS of Saudi Arabia, would be only too happy if the former president returned or a Republican avatar. They're much more comfortable with the Republican Party. Some have argued that the Democrats in the U.S. represent the sort of center-left range of political parties in Israel, and Likud has come to represent the Republican Party. There are clear ties. There's no question about that, though, both material ties and ideological ties. Populism, an intense sort of nationalism, common elements.
That's fascinating in terms of the political breakdown. How about, if one can generalize, how about the American Jewish community? Are they just as divided as, in a sense, Israelis themselves in terms of their support for Netanyahu or the opposition, or is it more complicated?
Hard to say. 5.8 million American Jews, half of whom are not affiliated with a synagogue or any Jewish organization. The activist portion of the community, I think, is very divided, increasingly so. Even the major Jewish organizations, which on the center and the right, which have been reluctant to criticize Israeli policy publicly and openly, have been out there expressing their dismay and concern over the drift or the acceleration of this judicial reform effort. You know, I try to stay away from Jewish inside baseball.
Yeah, gotcha.
My 25 years at working in the State Department on these issues have led me to believe that there's only one Jewish person, that is more important than any other. And that's the prime minister of Israel's impact on an American president.
Gotcha.
I would argue that in many respects, the organized Jewish community, as relevant and as influential as it would like to think it is not nearly as important as the impact of one guy,
right,
the prime minister, on the president. And I must say, you indicated that Benjamin Netanyahu is annoyed by Biden. I mean, the reality is, in the annoyance category, Biden is far more annoyed, even angered, I suspect, by what's happening. And I think this administration, look, as a matter of course, American presidents do not like to fight with Israeli prime ministers. It's messy, it's awkward, it's distracting, it could be politically risky. Biden has gone out of his way in the last 3 months since this coalition was formed to give Netanyahu a room to maneuver. In fact, I've never seen any administration engage this early, this frequently, and at such a senior level with any Israeli government. You had Jake Sullivan there. You had Bill Burns there. You had Tony Blinken there. You had Mark Milley there. You had Lloyd Austin there. This is all in the course of 3 months. So I think Biden now understands that the Netanyahu of old, risk-averse, cautious, pragmatic, the Bibi about whom he said, "I love you, Bibi, but I disagree with everything that you said."
Right.
That Bibi, his nickname, seems to have morphed into something else. And I think the administration is now understanding. I gave a quote to the New York Times this morning that basically said, this is the worst crisis in the history of the U.S.-Israeli relationship. It's a crisis over the image of Israel as a liberal, democratic, pluralistic society. That image is what's at stake here. And if, in fact, this liberal slide continued, I think the image of Israel would fundamentally be altered in the minds not just of the general public, where things are changing as well, but also in the minds of the political elites. And add to that the partisanship, you'd have a U.S.-Israeli relationship that was not nearly as resilient, durable, or special as it's been for decades.
So let's discuss how this all relates to the prime minister's legal troubles. He is facing corruption charges, and obviously he has to be concerned about his political future, and that without getting in his head about his political motivations necessarily, it does seem that he's not necessarily an unbiased observer with respect to the power of the judiciary in Israel. Is there an element to which his decisions on this determine not only the fate of his coalition and his remaining in office in that regard, but also could have some bearing on his legal jeopardy?
Yeah. I mean, I think if the legislation, the one law in particular that is now ready for passage, in fact, I think it's passed the first reading and it requires three, the second, third readings could pass in 45 minutes, which would give the government the edge in selecting justices. There's also an element here of a law has also been passed, and it is now the law that pertaining to the fitness of the prime minister, the prime minister can be declared unfit only if he decides, he or she, or the majority of the cabinet decides. And if they can't, then you need 80 Knesset members to declare a prime minister unfit. That is a huge number of humans in almost a supermajority in a 120-person Knesset. So that would shield him. He wants the French law, I think, at a minimum, which would prevent the prosecution and trial of a sitting president. And I think delay is what he has in mind. He's 73 years old. You could argue this could be his last turn at the wheel. This is a four-year government if it went to term. Trial's been on now for 3 years. The precedent, by the way, and why the Israeli judicial system needs reform, this is a trial that he was indicted 3 years ago. Ehud Olmert, who was indicted not a former prime minister, who was indicted not as a sitting prime minister but as a private citizen, I think from the time of his indictment to the time of his conviction and incarceration for 16 months, 6 years.
That is a really long delay.
Think
so
about
that. He can run out the clock, conceivably.
Right. And I think that really is the strategy. Plus the notion, the longer he's prime minister managing things adeptly and adroitly, the more the notion that these charges against him in the minds of many people are going to fade. People are going to say, you know, the guy's doing a great job, great economy, startup nation. We're fairly secure. He's tough on Iran. Israel's image in the world. Israel is recognized today by more countries and more deeply integrated in the international system than at any time since independence.
That's precisely where I wanted to go next. Sort of thinking about the regional or even global dimensions of this crisis, Israel has, as you're intimating, made huge strides in normalizing relations, not least with Arab nations, including through the Abraham Accords. What do you think the attitude is in the region, and are there any implications of this particular crisis and its outcome for Israeli diplomacy and security?
You know, the key issue that's going to affect the regional view of Israel is probably not the issue of judicial reform. I mean, after all, let's look at Israel's neighbors, right? I mean, they're hardly a collection of first Democrats club, right? You got Jordan, you got Sisi in Egypt. You've got, of course, the most oppressive authoritarian crown prince, the Emiratis. I mean, so the Chinese, the Russians, all those relationships are secure from the standpoint of judicial reform. Where the Netanyahu government could get itself into trouble is on the Palestinian issue with respect to the agreements that the Abraham Accords that were reached in 2020 with Bahrain, Morocco, and the Emirates, and any impending effort to normalize relations with Saudi Arabia. If the Palestinian issue blows up, even though these key regional states, I think, are trying to separate themselves and protect their own interests to a degree they never were prepared to do in the past, that's where it's going to cost the Israelis. And, you know, we're entering Ramadan, Passover, Easter, traditionally heightened religious sensitivities, blood is up. I mean, you could end up with an explosion in addition to the crisis that you've got now of judicial reform, which could impact, if it became severe enough, Israel's relations with the Abraham Accord countries and, of course, its treaty partners in Jordan and in Egypt.
Because you earlier in the show, you noted that this is the judicial reform issue is just one half of, in a sense, the agenda that the Netanyahu government is pushing. And the other is really about annexation and sort of the end of the two-state solution.
Right. And that effort, it seems to me, is right now unstoppable.
So it's been so down the road, it's just in train.
I mean, I continue to believe that if you had the right leadership, you could still create some sort of end of conflict agreement based on separation through negotiations, giving the a Palestinian state sovereignty. But even to talk about that now under these current circumstances, you need leaders, the likes of Sadat, Menachem Begin, Rabin, King Hussein, to produce that. And there's no indication that either the leadership or the politics on either side of the line, even according, especially on the side of the Palestinians, who are divided and dysfunctional with Hamas in Gaza and Fatah in the West Bank, a coherent, willful, heroic leadership, I don't see it on either side.
So let's turn to the next phase of the current crisis that we've been talking about. I understand that the government and the opposition have begun negotiations on this judicial reform issue. Is there any room for compromise? The two camps seem to be relatively broad themselves in terms of their willingness to compromise in the sense that there are divisions within them. In terms of what would be satisfactory in terms of from the opposition side, how much rollback of the entire idea of judicial reform from Netanyahu's side, of course, some maximalists, ultra-conservatives, who want nothing but total victory. Is there room in this sort of broad coalition on both sides for some sort of compromise?
You know, the president of Israel, Isaac Herzog, has tried for the last several months to consult with jurists, academics, experts on constitutional law and on the judiciary to try to develop a compromise. A compromise would work if the issues on the table were not tethered as tightly as they are to two huge obstacles. One is the political ambitions behind judicial reform. This is not just a question of trying to figure out a neat compromise on a constitutional or a juridical or legal basis to satisfy both sides. It's tethered to these objectives. And number two, the sense of mistrust and lack of confidence. There are ongoing negotiations. President Herzog started them a few days back. But none, interestingly enough, none of the Netanyahu's lieutenants who were instrumental in producing these reforms are a part of the government's negotiating team. So that, I mean, the hopeful sign would be, well, you're not going to let the most radicalized elements in the negotiations. The other thing, the other sign is that I am inclined to believe this, that Netanyahu doesn't think there's much of a chance that these are going to succeed. And I don't know how you resolve this, because if you can't, and the pause ends on May 1st, and the one bill that is now ready that could pass the Knesset in an hour, second and third readings pass, then you have the constitutional, even though Israel has no formal written constitution, crisis. At that point, you have what happens. Orders go out from the government to do X, Y, and Z, and the people receiving the orders say, I'm following the judiciary. You are an illegitimate government. You are governing without constitutional or legal claim. I won't follow those orders. And some do, some don't.
I was going to ask you how this all ends, and it sounds to me like it's sort of, heading a bit for a precipice. And the question I also had was, is this just one salvo in a sort of a longer term political civil war that's sort of unfolding in Israel?
Could I rule out the prospects of civil war in Israel? I would like to. I can't imagine. Think of civil war between armed combatants struggling over pieces of territory, the IDF splintering into various factions, armed factions, the police now under the control of Itamar Ben-Gvir, self-described arsonist and Jewish supremacist, ordering certain elements of the police. Some choose to obey, some don't. I mean, I cannot. In 2020, there were many rabbit holes constructed by very smart people in this country, political scientists, about what the risks would be of an insurrection or a constitutional crisis here. Never happened. You had January 6th. Never happened. Beyond that, it's bad enough. Could I imagine that in Israel? Hard to. But I don't know how you resolve this. Constitutional crises are either resolved through force or through compromise. I just don't see the latter. I don't see the vision, the clear picture on the latter right now.
Well, you've painted a sobering picture, to say the least, of the current state of Israel, but also one that's deeply informed. And that brings us to the end of our show. But I want to thank you so much for the insights that you've been able to provide. And we can't wait to have you back on the show in the future to discuss not only the Middle East, but of course, other aspects of American foreign policy, which you are so adept at explicating and making sense of.
Stuart, thanks so much. And you're a great host.
Thanks so much, Aaron. Thanks for listening to The World Unpacked, brought to you by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts, and please don't forget to rate and subscribe. The World Unpacked is produced by Isabel Villegas and Clarissa Guerrero and edited by our audio engineer, Tim Martin. Catch you next time.